Welcome to Making Sense of MarTech, an irregular set of conversations with some of the most interesting people in marketing, tech, and advertising. I'm Maya Mendoza. I write the MarTech Weekly Newsletter. It's a weekly email that covers important shifts in marketing tech. People who work at some of the largest media, tech, and marketing companies read it. You can read, listen, and subscribe at themartechweekly.com. Okay, today we are joined by Gareth Noonan. He's a leader in the world of B2B ad tech and MarTech. Someone whose expertise has actually led to some very interesting innovations. So Gareth Noonan he's an accomplished general manager. He's recognized for spearheading international cross-functional teams in sales, customer experience, and operations. With a track record of steering businesses units to generate more than $150 million in revenue, Gareth's proficiency extends to programmatic advertising, operations, sales, business development, product management. He's been there. He's seen it all. He's done it all. He's also an expert in mobile app and desktop video, OTT, native and display advertising across all screens. Gareth has also held some very interesting positions across the industry. He served as a general manager for Americas at Smarto. He was driving impactful strategies in the ad tech landscape there. Also, he was the SVP of operations at Adformix, and he continued to contribute to the industry in his most recent role as the general manager of advertising at Demandbase. In this conversation, we talk about the journey of building Demandbase's demand-side platform and their pivotal shifts in the ad tech thinking, the challenges of adapting B2B, B2C-centric ad tech to the intricate and very unique landscape of business-to-business marketing, the significance of B2B-specific demand-side platforms and ad tech for companies that are building account-based marketing platforms like Demandbase, the concept of the dark funnel in marketing, and its impact on B2B campaigns. And lastly, we explore the rise of connected TV in the B2B realm. And now I give you Gareth. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks, Juan. Thanks for the intro and congratulations on minimizing the acronyms in there. That's always a challenge with ad tech and MarTech. It is a world of many, many acronyms.
Well, yes, we are guilty of that. I don't know what's worse, the buzzwords or the acronyms at this point. They're probably conspiring together to make us even more confused. But Gareth, I want to know, you've been across so many different parts of the ad tech and MarTech world. What got you started in the ad tech space initially? What got you into it?
Wow, that's an interesting question. So actually, it was with a company I worked for in the west of Ireland in the mid-2000s. I'm originally from Ireland, but lived in the US immediately after college. And gave it a shot in the mid-2000s to go back for a period and partnered with a company that was primarily in the web development and systems integration space. But they saw the challenge of sort of like, you know, one-off engagements. And I was talking to them about ways that maybe they could have more kind of ongoing residual revenue and suggested, you know, digital marketing and, you know, search engine marketing was pretty nascent at the time. So suggested to them that that would be a good add-on for the web design and systems integration they were doing. And so that was where I cut my teeth in all things AdWords, Bing, et cetera. And then shortly thereafter, when economic headwinds hit Ireland, moved back to the US. And the skills that I developed during that kind of brief stint were actually, you know, in pretty serious demand. And a lot of programmatic advertising was just kind of starting to take off. So yeah, that was what got me into it in the first place.
And when was that, when you made that shift from Ireland to the US and in the midst of this?
2007. Yeah, 2007. So a boom time in terms of sort of ad tech and MarTech in the Bay Area.
You go. Were you one of those people that stood in line at the Apple store when the iPhone was released?
I wasn't, no. I'm an Android guy. Always was and still am because I see, you know, Google being so central to the ad tech ecosystem that, you know, I'm kind of all in with those guys. I'm more sort of, I guess, function over form.
Oh, really? So you're a Pixel user, huh? Or Android, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people made their mark back in that period from 2005 to 2015. That 10-year stretch was just one of the most interesting times working, particularly in programmatic advertising and ad tech specifically. And so I can imagine back then it would have been probably equally frustrating and like challenging because the tech wasn't there, but also exciting as well. What was your experience sort of working in that period?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And my sort of entry when I moved to the Bay Area was in the online video space specifically. And it was right around the time that YouTube, you know, was becoming prominent and then was quickly acquired by Google. And so, you know, video as a medium for, you know, for search, for user generated content, and then obviously for advertising, you know, was really starting to blow up. But to your point, you know, I think programmatic is generally considered to have started in 2007, you know, with, you know, with Brian O'Kelly and other folks around kind of like Right Media. And before that, a lot of people, myself included, were almost manually doing programmatic, I would say, you know, where I was kind of with a team of ad ops professionals running what you might call a manual exchange of looking at, well, who are our buyers and how do we, you know, waterfall from the top bid down to the next bid, down to the bid below that. And how do you layer data on top of it? And then obviously, you know, a lot of smart people with a lot of resources came in and did that more algorithmically. But yeah, it was an exciting time. And, you know, the people who were doing it right were definitely very successful and still are quite prominent in the industry.
Yeah, I can imagine video, when the acquisition of YouTube was that watershed event, I think, was that situation where, oh, wow, video could actually be a massive part of ad tech, but also a massive part of the consumer's experience online as well. You know, I think video and mobile during that period were the tandem forces, I think. You know, we had both those things. But even now, you know, 15 years later, we've got TikTok, which, you know, unbelievable what they've been able to do in terms of their growth by focusing natively on video and building a social media platform just on video itself. And so we're continuing to see video influence so much of ad tech, which is fascinating. But before we talk about, I guess, video and connected TV, and that's right at the end of this recording, what we're going to dive into is demand base itself. Now, what I found fascinating, and when we actually met, so a bit of a note for the listeners, Gareth and I met in a bar in the middle of a casino in Las Vegas, and then we struck up a conversation just randomly. I think
that's where it was a business meeting.
Yeah, just after a conference. I think the trade desk folks were just across the aisle there on the other side of the bar. And we started striking up this conversation. And you told me all about demand bases shift into ad tech with the rollout of your DSP and what you've been doing over the past several years. And I found that fascinating because you don't hear about a lot of account-based marketing, RevOps, B2B, and even sales platforms getting into ad tech. And so I'd love for you to unpack that journey. What does it look like, I guess, for a B2B focused marketing technology to get into programmatic advertising and building a DSP?
Yeah. So I think at a high level, it really is just, you know, completely serving the whole go-to-market lifecycle for your customers. But to kind of step back a bit and you know, kind of fill in the blanks on demand base a bit. So you know, demand base would be very well known in the MarTech space, obviously, you know, for you and your counterparts, Juan, around account-based marketing. And originally, ABM was kind of a strategy, let's say, and demand base would be considered the first company that actually built a platform to put a technology behind that. And then, you know, over the years, obviously, a lot of demand-based customers, they were, you know, very positive on the account identification, the account selection, prioritization, then bringing in intent, all of those things. But a question then was always, okay, but how do we activate on this now? And so that was when the demand-based team thought that it made sense to create an advertising platform that would act on all of those insights and all of those optimizations and the segmentation capabilities that happened in the ABM platform and really give that sort of activation layer that would still be in an account-based context and that would really understand the B2B nuances that aren't really available or accommodated for in more B2C tech, because needless to say, a lot of, you know, businesses that might've been using ABM platforms or, you know, were just in the B2B space generally, the only option that was available to them programmatically was B2C demand side platforms, DV360 by Google, Trade Desk, historically MediaMath and others. Fantastic technologies, incredible platforms, deservedly successful in their fields, but you know, they're about that consumer sort of transaction, which as we know is very, very different to a B2B transaction. The example that I use a lot is if you're a consumer and you're buying a pair of boots, you're kind of traversing the web, you look at a pair of boots, you pick a size, you drop them in the shopping cart, you move on. But the consideration is very, very low level compared to B2B buying cycles involving tens, hundreds, thousands, millions of dollars. Very, very lengthy buying cycles, many, many people involved, like this kind of key account-based marketing concept of the buying committee. And so the tech that you use to advertise, you know, should be consistent with those sort of buying cycles and those nuances. And really at the heart of it is the account object. you know, when people ask me, well, what's a B2B DSP? Why is it different? And, you know, why should I care? There are many, many reasons. One of them is the account object and understanding, you know, that many individuals go into that sort of buying decision. And then you have to layer on the factors of like intent. How do you prioritize the individuals on the buying committee versus, as you know, people often ask us, how do I know I'm not advertising to the intern? And then obviously there's the identification piece as well. Like you only want to be advertising to people that you know are from your target account. And, you know, those are sort of the inherent strengths of a fit for purpose ABM platform are identification, account selection and prioritization, intent, et cetera. And then all of that signal feeds into the DSP.
Could you break down for our audience, because some people listening may not have a lot of awareness around what a DSP is. Could you break us down? What's the main components in a DSP?
Sure. So a demand side platform is really the, you know, the programmatic world's buying tool. And so it's very much data driven buying, where instead of buying eyeballs based on content, you know, back in the day of ad networks, like before true programmatic, you would basically buy websites or sections of websites. You would say, you know, I want to reach auto intenders, so I'm going to buy the, you know, the auto section of the City Morning Herald, for example, or I want to, you know, reach moms, quote unquote. So I'm going to be on, you know, lifestyle sites or, you know, kind of like news sites or whatever it might be. And then programmatic actually brought the individual audience data to the game, where you recognize who individuals are based on cookies, based on other sort of identifiers, hashed emails, whatever it might be. And you know the browsing behavior and the buying behavior of these individuals. Like they're always anonymized. It's, you know, PII is very much part of the equation, but you can sort of track their behavior across the web. And so it's targeting and measurement of individuals versus just kind of based on the environment that they're in. I would say that's probably the most kind of high level description of a DSP that I would give.
So it is based on the actual data that you're collecting, third party data, first party data, to inform a specific target that you're trying to reach, whether that be a profile of a type of business or a persona within that business. And using the DSP, you can actually target those users wherever they are on the web or whenever they visit specific websites. Is that a good summary?
Yeah,
of
it is. And then literally bidding higher based on the amount of data that you have for the user behind the impression that you are seeing. And, you know, in this case, it's sort of analogous to like high frequency trading and financial markets. Yeah. It's literally auctions that are happening. And, you know, I think it's interesting to explain. A lot of your listeners will probably understand this, but for some, you know, who aren't as close to it, like it really is super interesting to understand what happens when you fire up an app, what happens when you fire up a website, and that literally thousands, if not tens of thousands of decisions are being made in the background in near real time to decide what ads you're going to see.
Yeah. And that's the thing I think we miss with the ad tech space is how much innovation is in that. To your point, in milliseconds, you know, almost in real time, there is bidding happening, there is placements happening, there's personalizations happening, you know, behind most publisher websites. And that is fascinating, right? But I want to zoom in a little bit on the B2B aspect of things. And you've already mentioned sort of the unique opportunity here, which is a lot of B2B companies would go to a MediaMath or a Google or whatever to run, and they're B2C networks, to run their B2B advertising, but having a B2B focused ad tech company that they can actually run advertising through is obviously an interesting opportunity. But what are some of the nuances? You mentioned a couple, like your accounts, you make sure you don't want to advertise to the intern. Can you go a little bit deeper into that in terms of the nuances of how you would do B2B advertising? You know, for example, you know, there's usually like a parent-child relationship, organization, and then individuals, and then individuals, and then potentially their staff or their team with under them as well. How granular can you actually get in the B2B world when you're targeting folks with ads?
Yeah, so let's start at the highest level, which is the company identification. And so, you know, again, a MarTech platform, like an ABM platform that is then sort of plugged into an activation layer of a DSP. You know, the first step is the identification. And so, you know, there are various offerings out there in the B2B world that will associate a user with the company that they work for. You know, IP obviously is one of the signals there, but also cookies and also other kind of like hashed identifiers. I can give you an example of that demand base, you know, how we kind of approach it from a, like an AI perspective to really kind of form the confidence of that identification. Is, you know, we've mapped billions of IPs globally. We'll then have cookies that we can layer on where we kind of like triangulate based on a cookie and IP association, and you can dial one or other up or down, you know, based on the kind of the confidence score. And as you can imagine, you know, one of the questions we get a lot is when COVID happened and everyone started working from home, what on earth did that do to company identification? If you were previously very dependent on IP and it was based on the offices that people were in, well, that was where the cookies came in, because we could then sort of like remap. If we had an IP and cookie combination and we knew that it was Tesla, you know, we would then see, well, this IP or this cookie is now, you know, we're seeing it on a different IP and we're seeing it consistently. So now we can identify or, you know, reasonably assume that this is the person's home IP. And then we start layering on things like, are they still checking the Tesla stock ticker? Are they checking the weather in Fremont, California? And you layer on like all of that sort of signal to make a confident identification. And so it starts there. And then, you know, the second sort of leg of the stool is this intent. You know, what is this user reading and researching in apps out on the open web that give us reason to believe that they are an influencer, recommender, decision maker for, you know, what our customer is selling? And then, you know, there's literally intent scores that you assign there based on confidence. And then, you know, there's also the importance of the account association for load balancing across accounts in campaigns. So an example that I give is Oracle. Like if you have, you know, 10 large global enterprises in an account list for a campaign, but one of them is Oracle, there could be so many people within that organization, given its scale, that are showing intent. They could rapidly suck up all of your budget if you don't understand that Oracle is a distinct account. And so are these other ones. And so you can load balance at the account level. In other DSPs that can't make that association, yeah, you can frequency cap at the individual level. But if you don't know all those individuals are working for the same account, you know, you have this kind of like budget sucking kind of problem. So, you know, it's the consistency then of identification from the ABM platform into the DSP is obviously super important. Like if you're taking an audience out of like ABM and then trying to activate it on a third party B2C DSP, you could literally have different identification. Like you could be in your ABM platform, be correctly identifying it as, you know, as Oracle. And then when it goes into the DSP, it's using different identification potentially, and it's identified as a completely different company. And you know, the intent in those B2C DSPs for B2B tends to be off the shelf segments that could be 2 months old with a 3 month look back. In a B2B DSP, it's real time intent that you're pulling from the biz stream. So those I think are some of the high level differentiators. You know, ones that have certainly proven important to our customers. I mean, without sharing specific names, we work with some of the biggest ad tech companies in the world as customers of ours. They own their own B2C DSPs, but when they're selling their products to B2B buyers, the differentiation of what we're doing.
The irony in that is not lost on me, given that those ad tech companies already built, they've already got their own DSP. Wouldn't they just shift into B2B? But I think the unique opportunity is this background in account-based marketing. And this whole area, revenue operations, sales ops, and account-based marketing is this holy trinity of like, you know, like ruthless, like very targeted, very efficient marketing in the B2B space, right? And what I find fascinating about it is like the consumer world and the business world have totally different understandings of the ethics and also the level of data that you can collect. You know, nowadays, particularly with third-party cookies going away and other, you know, privacy enforcements, for say, from Apple and the regulators as well, you know, B2C data is becoming harder to collect. I mean, you know, you have to get more consent, you know, there's less data sharing. But, you know, in B2B, the terminology is like, this is business card data. Someone gives you a business card or they put some on some tables at a conference. You just pick that up. You got their name and their email address, their role and their company, right? And like, if you go to, say, a Clearbit or a Zoom Info, you can basically just add a pixel onto your website in the similar ways what you guys do, and you can identify users that are coming through to your website and which business they work in. And I find that fascinating in that it seems as though the B2B world, everyone is kind of okay with that level of data collection because it's not personal. It's you work in a business, and that corporate information is usually available on LinkedIn anyway or in business cards, as I mentioned. And so that's kind of the fascinating opportunity. You can get this really cool granular targeting on accounts and professionals and what they're working on and what they're interested in, but it doesn't necessarily invade their privacy. But did you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think it speaks to then the importance of the personalization of your message the fact, not bombarding people with outreach sequences, et cetera, or advertising that is just completely irrelevant to them, because there is that sort of trust and value exchange of, okay, it's a B2B use case, but you have enough data on me, surely, that you can only target me with relevant messaging. And then, you know, that you, what you're talking about here as well is obviously very adjacent to kind of like first party data activation. You know, in our case, most of our customers were integrated into their CRM, into their Salesforce, their HubSpot, et cetera. We're integrated into their marketing automation, you know, be that Marketo, Eloqua, et cetera. And that's a massive part of, you know, orchestrating those audiences, you know, via email, into social and search walled gardens like LinkedIn, like AdWords, and then obviously out to programmatic advertising as well.
Mm. And you get a better picture. And that, I think that's the point, is that if you understand the, that user's role, which company they're in, and then say they subscribe to a white paper or a webinar or something.
Where the intent comes in. Absolutely.
Yeah. The intent levels change. I mean, you know, I'm assuming you guys at Demandbase do a lot of MQL, SQL type work, marketing qualified lead, sales qualified lead type work. You know, all of that, all of those intent signals, you know, depending on the sophistication of companies, some companies actually use machine learning, depending on the volume of what they're working with. But, you know, there is a lot of value in just establishing intent and the level of interest in a product or a service or multiple products, you know, because B2B buying journeys are so, like, it's less casual. It's more like, I'm actually got a remit and a budget, and I need to buy some technology, and I'm in market, and I'm learning a ton of stuff. And so the understanding that intent must be so valuable for your customers.
It is. And I mean, it really is central to so much of what we do in terms of the value that, you know, ABX platforms and account intelligence platforms bring. Because, you know, you mentioned at the top of our conversation, the concept of the dark funnel. And, you know, that's where we start to kind of get into that concept that today, B2B buyers are, you know, before they explicitly raise their hand via, you know, attending a webinar, filling out a form, et cetera, they've done, you know, a massive percentage. You know, you can, it's kind of subjective how much, obviously, but people say up to 80% of the buyer journey is complete before someone explicitly raises their hand and decides that they want somebody from the company they're investigating to come and talk to them. And so what you're trying to do is identify, you know, when your target accounts are starting to research. You know, I mean, only, I think our chief marketing officer, John Miller, published an article recently. I think he said only 5% of any, you know, company's target accounts are actively in market at any, you know, given time. So for the other 95%, you're really trying to frame their thinking, educate them on when they are, you know, either looking for a new vendor for, you know, a piece of their tech stack, or when they're going to expand into a new area that requires a new technology. Who are they going to be thinking of? Like, who are they going to be the top three vendors they're going to evaluate? And, you know, that's a sort of a, you know, it's a cadence and a message and a reach that you have to be establishing months, years in advance. And then, you know, knowing who are those accounts that are showing those dark funnel kind of signals that they're starting to kind of lean in and they're starting to show interest in you, so that you can get the right messaging in front of them and continue to guide their thinking. And, you know, not just when they're ready, but maybe you can even accelerate that readiness by, you know, putting a sufficient value prop in front of them or educating them on the use case that makes them think, hang on, what I thought was a priority for next year, I got to do it this year.
Mm. So the dark funnel concept is when accounts, customers are not yet ready to buy, but they're still browsing, there's still opportunities to educate them. Is that how you frame it?
Yeah, exactly. Where they haven't explicitly raised their hand, where they are researching your market and potentially you, but they're not yet ready to have an explicit outreach and say, I want to talk to, you know, an AE, or I want to attend a webinar or a demo.
Yeah. And so I think it's interesting because that relies a lot on your understanding of a customer's journey. You know, in B2B, it's a lot more complex, I think, often, because there's so many more touch points compared to B2C. You've got, you know, you may, as you, to your point out, like there's an education, there's an awareness aspect to the journey. Then there's perhaps a trigger point in their business when they're actually looking to buy new technology or replace it, or to, you know, buy software or services from a company. And then they go into this cycle of learning more and then perhaps talking to a sales agent and then maybe engage with more content. And then maybe they put out an RFP, you know, or maybe they actually go out and ask for proposals. And that's a totally different journey as well. You know, there's responses and interactions. And then you finally get to closing a deal, you know, when you actually have a customer that's okay, ready to sign and to buy a contract. And then there's a process to onboard them. You know, so there's actually like I reckon 3 to 5 times more interactions in B2B than you would see in most B2B compared to B2C use cases. But is that what you see as well?
Absolutely.
Way more touch points. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, and that's again where, an ABX platform comes in. You should have customizable buyer journeys. I mean, we work obviously with customers across, pretty much every B2B vertical. And what works in healthcare doesn't necessarily work in tech. What works in FinServe, doesn't necessarily work in travel, for example. And so that's customization within the buyer journeys and, across, are you an MQL shop? Are you an SQL shop? Are you an MQA shop? Being able to customize that and your predictive models around, like we have concepts like qualification score, for example, being able to score accounts against your ideal customer profile and how they match. And then, pipeline predict, which is, based on all of the inputs that we have and how we have scored this account against what we see in your CRM and previous behavior, we'll give you like a score of how likely we think it is that this account is going to enter pipe in, the next quarter, 2 quarters, whatever it might be. So again, the point is customization.
Yeah. And that's it. Like the ability to forecast pipeline, every business needs that. Because you know what? The CEO's on the phone asking for it, what does next quarter look like?
Look, I say to people all the time, I think CMO is the toughest job in the C-suite right now, has been for a while. So it's it really is immediate accountability.
Yeah, but I like that idea of matching potential leads and, at different stages of qualification with it's almost like a reverse lookalike in a way. And like, okay, these are the customers that we've actually closed, the high value ones, the low churn ones. And how do these ones match in terms of what we know about them so far? Like, that's a really interesting idea, because I'm assuming that would transition you into a DSP where you would actually go, okay, these are our contacts that are really highly correlated to success for us, And so that's different from like in B2B, B2C world, where you would send a first party data audience and go, Meta, Google, create a lookalike audience based on that. It's very different from what you guys are doing, which is actually let's match it against your real customers here and see which ones look very similar to the successful accounts.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, just to kind of reiterate on the DSP side, we own data assets and sales intelligence assets. Yeah. Literally we would describe as the data layer, and then the ABX platform can be seen as the decisioning layer of the account segmentation, prioritization, all of those things. And then the DSP is the activation layer, in addition to, other kind of omni-channel orchestrations that we offer, where you can also, the audiences that you're reaching via outreach sequences, Sales Loft, whatever it might be, you're also reaching on the DSP. And then you're also pushing those same audiences potentially into walled gardens like LinkedIn, AdWords, Twitter, Meta, whatever it might be.
Can I give you an example of where this stuff falls down? So a few weeks ago, I was in market and I was doing some work with a particular vendor, and the vendor, I kind of had a hard stop with them. Their solution didn't really match what I needed for the next step in my business. So I went to another vendor, and it looked like their offering seemed pretty relevant to what I was after. And so I go onto their website, right? And I'm on their website and I'm like, all I want to know is how much does this stuff cost? And what is the process to get onboarded? That's what I'm after. And on their website, there's a big red button that says get pricing. Okay. Oh, it's actually worse than that. It says just pricing. I click on the pricing page, expected to be greeted by a lovely page with, the 3 or 4 different package options, and you can go away and pick one. I'm not greeted with that. I'm actually greeted by a form. You have to fill out the form and then get contacted by a sales rep. Okay. I fill out the form. I'm like, I'm keen. High intent. I'm a high intent B2B customer wanting to buy software. Very interested. I would need to know the pricing. Okay. I fill out the form. I get through the form. And then next day I get a phone call from a sales rep. And I asked the sales rep, hey, can you send me your info pack with your pricing and options? And they said, oh, I'm not qualified to do that. You'll have to take a video call with our actual account executive. Can we set up a meeting with you? And I said, hey, I'm busy. I'm on a phone call with you right now, and you're saying you cannot give me your pricing. And I look at that as like a failure of a customer experience. I will not go with, if that's how they treat their customers, where I have to jump through, where I'm mistakenly thinking I'm going to see pricing, have to fill out a form, that's a point of friction, then get contacted and not being able to get the information I requested, another point of friction, that's already 2 points of friction, and I have to jump on a video call and get sold to. So like, I look at all of that and I see that that's a failure. That's an account-based marketing failure. I'm a high intent customer, been checking these people out for a little while, and they haven't been able to jump on that opportunity and just give me the information I'm after. Now, I'm sure in B2B, you see a lot of that as well over in the years that you've worked in this space. But my question to you, Gareth, is like, where in businesses, how do they coordinate so they can get these experiences right? Who owns it? How do they run it? How do they use vendors like Demandbase? What does that look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, what you just described, well, makes my head hurt because pipeline is so large to, you know, you earn every MQL, MQA, SQL, however you measure it in your pipe these days, you earn it the hard way. So a qualified user who's just looking for pricing, showing high intent and being made to jump through those hoops, it's just not how it should be. So the teams that we work with, just to kind of like explain the evolution of ABM to ABX a bit. So ABM obviously was account-based marketing. In recent years, there really has been a transition to account-based experience because almost by definition, the ABM label didn't include sales. And yet one of the core tenets of ABM has always been sales and marketing alignment. And so we work with revenue leaders on the sales side of the house to drive insights and to help them prioritize which accounts in their territory they should be reaching out to now and with which message. And then obviously we also work with their counterparts on the marketing side, from a digital marketing, campaign management, all of those kinds of perspectives. And so traditionally over the years, we may have worked with like dedicated ABM teams, especially I would say, and you know, within larger global enterprises that have the resources, there could be certain divisions that have dedicated ABM teams that we would work with. And then that grows as people saw the success and the ROI that would grow into other divisions. And then obviously in the, you know, the venture-backed mid-market segment, where you tend to have like a scrappy marketer wearing many, many hats, you know, working very closely with the VP of sales that might have kind of three AEs, we would work very directly with both of those leaders and, you know, guide them on all of the aspects of sort of like the, you know, the account selection and prioritization, the insights going to their sellers, and then how to maximize their campaigns. And on the marketing side, just the consistency you measured, like around personalization from the creative to the landing, minimizing the friction of the form, you know, having a forms product that would kind of pre-populate the most important fields and advise people, you know, why have 12 fields when you only need 4, all of those things. So both via the product and via kind of like, you know, expert consultative advice available within Demandbase. So that's how we've helped our customers grow and be successful.
So we're talking here about a full picture of the journey. And I think the missing piece, which Demandbase is trying to solve now, is this whole DSP, like integrating advertising into those journeys, into those experiences, which I think for B2B has obviously been the missing piece. And it's so fascinating. But from your assessment of the industry, I mean, what companies are like sophisticated, what share of companies are sophisticated enough to do that full funnel, full journey planning and execution from everything from running ads, targeting users, and then getting that insight to doing really great outreach all the way through to email marketing and you know, MQL, SQL to CRM and sales. You know, there are so many moving pieces in this, but what share of the industry do you think, off the top of your head, do you think B2B companies are actually doing this well? Is it 10%? Is it 5%? Or is it like 80% are doing this actually really well? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a good, better, best kind of, situation where, ABM, like I said, started as a strategy, became a technology. I don't think it's sort of considered to be niche anymore. Like the vast majority of companies in the B2B space are basically doing some version of ABM. And, you know, some teams, needless to say, based on resources, based on experience, are more knowledgeable than others and tend to be very hands-on in the platform. But I would say most of our customers actually benefit a lot and lean on us a lot for our services. So within the sort of the data sales intelligence and ABX side, we have, you know, specialized services and kind of consultative teams. And then on the advertising side, similarly, I lead a team called the ad campaign strategists that you could think of, you know, CX for advertising. And so, you know, customers know that there's a self-serve capability that they can run in the platform. But, you know, they tend to, in a lot of cases, lean on what we provide and make available to them to really do a lot of heavy lifting as well and be very kind of strategic and consultative. And so while they understand, they know how the platform works, in a lot of cases, they prefer to guide us and say, these are the outcomes we're looking to drive to. So we trust you as our partners to kind of help us get there. along the way will sort of course correct and optimize. Ultimately, the like our product roadmap for the last year or so has been very much around self-driving go-to-market.
Yes.
Holistically, like across everything. Yeah. The promise there is like just next best action being either very clearly recommended in the platform or just auto-optimized within the platform. And we already have a lot of that live. And it is going to be sort of the North Star from a product development perspective for the foreseeable future.
Hmm. Yeah, I could see how a lot of this is actually software driven. I mean, strategically, yes, you have to pivot, you have to run experiments, you have to try things. But once the strategy is in place, some software will do a fantastic job of actually accelerating a lot of your plans, but some of them will actually be a hinder or be a ceiling often, you know, for the companies that are a bit more
specific. You have to know what are your outcomes, like what are the outcomes you're driving to and how do you measure them? And then as long as, measurement against progress of those goals is clear in the platform, then the idea is kind of you trust the platform and your partners on the services org, et cetera. You know, in the B2C world of advertising, I would bring it back to the trade desk. You know, when I talked to friends of mine in the industry on the agency side and on the brand side, you know, what is it that you love about the trade desk for in the B2C context? It's they say people just trust it. You know, you put in your inputs. Yes. But in your kind of like your restraints and your outcomes, and you trust the platform is going to do it.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, given that you guys have started in account-based marketing and RevOps, you've already got a lot of that trust, I can imagine, because a lot of customers already rely on you for so much of their intelligence anyway. So that hop, skip, jump into the world of ad tech and programmatic is not perhaps as big as, say, other platforms. You know, it is fascinating. But I do want to finish with a conversation about connected TV. Now, CTV has been one of these categories this year, which is really taking off. We're seeing streamers increasingly getting into advertising, such as Netflix and others. We're seeing a lot more sophistication in just your traditional TV and being able to target users and collect data with things like smart TVs. But I mean, when I think about connected TV and any sort of teaming TV advertising and streaming, I immediately think about B2C, but Demandbase have actually announced some interesting work around this for B2B use cases for connected TV. Can you tell us what they are and the rationale behind the value of the opportunity of using connected TV for B2B use cases?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I mean, I think a lot of it starts with where is your audience and where are they spending time and attention? And, you know, I mean, this was another COVID trend where, you know, we couldn't go anywhere. We were very sort of limited in terms of what we were accustomed to in lifestyle. And, you know, the streaming platforms, obviously, they saw that as a timely opportunity for them to release a ton of content. And we all basically started binging, you know, series we hadn't watched over the years or the new stuff. And so, you know, that's where the eyeballs are. And then also for these platforms and even for the traditional sort of like cable providers that offer on-demand and sort of deferred viewing, you can target audiences very, very specifically based on, you know, that household's sort of browsing behavior, watching behavior. I mean, bear in mind that for a lot of cable providers, like I'll give the US example because obviously that's what I'm most familiar with. NBC Universal owns Comcast. Mm. Or Comcast owns NBC Universal, maybe the opposite way around. A Comcast box is sitting in your house. Your linear TV is coming through it. Your streaming TV is coming through it. Your internet is coming through it. So when you're browsing on the web, the IP that we're seeing from that box is the same as, you know, what we're seeing for the CTV streaming. And so, you know, you can see you can bring that web-based intent of what somebody's reading and researching. And that's, you can associate it to the same IP. And then, you know, we know that, as I mentioned previously, we've associated that IP potentially with a company. And so now basically start to deliver targeted B2B advertising to the users within that household that are being doing B2B research out on the web as well. And then, you know, there's the price point, obviously, as well. Like linear TV, traditionally, people have seen it as being like a very high barrier to entry in terms of the quality of the creative. You know, do you have to hire like Hollywood list actors with massive sort of production value, et cetera. And then how much does it cost literally to buy like, you know, TV advertising where you actually have kind of, you know, reduced view compared to digital. You definitely have like, you know, minimal view of who is it that you're actually reaching. And so that is the promise of connected TV, is that, you know, the audience that you're reaching, it is programmatic. And also, you know, you don't necessarily need to have the linear, the traditional kind of TV quality of advertising. In a lot of cases, it can be around animation. It can be around, you know, assets you're already using for pre-roll video, native video, whatever it might be. And then, you know, one thing I would add as well is from the, you know, from a recall perspective, like just the sight, sound and motion impact of TV, it benefits every other channel. Like there's research I saw that was published recently by Mountain, which is a CTV kind of creative platform actually owned by Ryan Reynolds. And they said that CTV increases recall on paid search by 22%, paid social by 11%. And also needless to say on paid, we felt that it was a channel that our customers were asking us about. And you know, there's absolutely targeting value and holistic value to kind of like, you know, raising the impact and recall of your other advertising around it. You know, the price points compared to linear TV, they're actually quite attractive and not that much more of a multiple than display.
It is interesting. I mean, even now with generative AI and, you know, the reducing costs of creating content, I can see how like things like CTV and streaming ads can actually be far more accessible, particularly to B2B, because B2C, if you're a big B2C company, you're using an agency, they have a media team, they're able to create those video assets and hire the celebrities that you mentioned. But in B2B, that's like very unusual to say the least, unless you're a huge top of the town, you know. And of course, you know, there's some fantastic, for example, like monday.com, Squarespace, you know, some fantastic like B2B brands that do wonderful work with, say, podcasting and YouTube ads. And they've spent a lot of money to build that, because I think for the reasons you mentioned, sight and sound is very good for recall and very good for positioning as a product. So, but there's only like a very small group of that do that so well. But most B2B brands are like scratching their head, like, okay, so how are we going to like get actors involved? Who does the video? Like, you know, there's a lot of, I think, a learning curve, but I think that will become easier. I think like even now I'm starting to see, particularly with generative AI, a lot of interesting solutions to make the video production process easier and more accessible. And so I think that may actually add fuel to the fire. I mean, as you point out, it seems like the price point for CTV ads is not that different to other channels. And so that's attractive.
No, it's not. It's like a small multiple of display, but nothing close to linear. And, you know, I think a very instructive data point is that 66%, this again came from, I think it was eMarketer, 66% of CTV advertisers never ran campaigns on linear TV.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay. So it is like a whole new cohort, whole new game, new learning, new domain. That's really fascinating as well.
That's a point that we've made to our customers, that it doesn't have to be Matthew McConaughey in a Salesforce ad or Gene Simmons and Ozzy Osbourne in a Workday campaign. It can be, you know, just sort of like animation with like, you know, appropriate imagery and everything in there.
Yeah. And, you know, there is like during COVID, an interesting step that Salesforce made actually was they launched their own streaming platform called Salesforce Plus to stream all their Dreamforce. Yep. And, you know, like, again, I'm not exactly sure the growth or the value of that. You know, it sounds like it was more of a step change for dealing with COVID. However, you know, B2B streaming can be quite valuable. I mean, there's a lot of B2B content in YouTube. I mean, there's a lot of video content out there. It's just tapping into that right audiences and context. You know, for example, when I, many, many years ago in a previous life, I was working as a chef. And when you work as a chef, the kitchens are very stressful places. It's extremely busy. It's hot. Sometimes when your head chef's upset with you, he might throw a plate at your face. You know, it's very busy, very hot, very stressful environment. And you know what? I used to come home after finishing my workday and I would put on TV. And guess what's on TV? MasterChef, one of the cooking competition show that's really popular in most parts of the world. And I remember watching it and I'm like, this is stressing me out even more. You know, I'm at work in the stressful kitchen and I get home and my friends and my roommates wanted to watch MasterChef. And I was like, gosh, this is annoying and frustrating. But I can imagine if you're, you know, an executive and you're working away, you get home and you just want to watch the next TV show, the next episode on Netflix, and you get hit with this B2B ad for some software you're actually looking for. I can imagine there has to be some work done around the context, because that might not actually lead to a good experience. You know, my example is just one of millions, but I can see how like context can really matter in B2B. And when a person transitions from their workday into their personal life, and then, you know, a lot of that is actually entertainment in their personal life, I could see how you'd have to be very sensitive around the context in which you're presenting your products.
Yeah, it's interesting though as well that, you know, we've heard from some of the customers that we've run that have run connected TV campaigns with us. You know, they will sometimes include their own company on the target account list because they want to get, you know, employees excited, executives excited, etc. And they will say that, you know, X executive or Y colleague said they saw our ad, you know, while watching, you know, Bloomberg, CNBC, whatever it might be. On demand, and you like almost jumped out of their seat, you know, like the, and you know, that's obviously a bit more kind of compelling when it's your own company, but also, you know, there is a sort of a pattern switching kind of concept that, you know, when you are, you know, consuming what you might call your B2C sort of life and something that is relevant to your career or decision that you're currently kind of thinking through comes on, you really notice it. And it's something that you kind of file in the back of your mind. And so, you know, I mean, I think those are sort of upsides. And then we also hear from the content producers, candidly, they've said, like a lot of the streaming companies that we work with, like we want more B2B advertising because ad repetitiveness is one of the big challenges for streaming these days. Hmm. And there are only so many, you know, car insurance and, you know, pharma ads that you can show to somebody in a limited number of ad breaks without kind of actually annoying them. And so that sort of diversity of messaging is actually very, very welcome.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess, you know, you've got this latent space when somebody takes off their business hat and then puts on their weekend or their evening hat, you know, where they are probably a little bit more receptive, you know.
Especially as a decision maker.
Yeah, decision maker, you might go, oh, you might see an ad, you know, you've heard something in the business around, you know, you might need something similar to that. You might go check it out. You've got your phone in hand. You might go search them up and have a look as well, you know. So I think that that latent space is a really interesting opportunity to me because there isn't in business and in most B2B dealings, there is no leisure time. You're there for a reason. You're on a call to sell or to buy. You're there to learn and every minute counts because you're on the clock. But in latent space, in the time where you're literally just hanging out on the couch, not much to do, you can kind of capture an audience in a different way, I think. It's not as efficiency and like to the point is probably not as important. Perhaps creativity and being memorable is more relevant in CTV in those contexts. And so,
yeah, and bringing some fun into it. You know, I mentioned, and you may not be familiar with it because maybe it just ran in the US, but Workday around the Super Bowl did a series of commercials around, you know, the concept of, oh, you're a rock star. My colleague is a rock star. Yes. And they had Gene Simmons in it and they had Ozzy Osbourne and I think they had like Billy Idol in it. And so they brought fun. Like it's a Workday message. It's clearly B2B, but they brought some fun to it.
And that's right. And I think that you can make it fun. I even look at the success of Dreamforce. I mean, you know, they get A-list celebrities, a lot of conferences these days, they'll get an A-list, few A-list celebrities and whatnot, not just people that work in that industry, you know? So there is an element of fun, enjoy, entertainment value as well in this space. Well, Gareth, this has been a fantastic conversation. We've covered so much ground. We've covered everything from CTV through to the dark funnel, all the way through to why demand base is getting into DSP and programmatic advertising. You've really shed some light onto this really interesting growing category. But my last question for you is, where can we find and interact with you online?
Sure. You can find me on LinkedIn, Gareth Newland, demand base. Not particularly active on Twitter/X/whatever it is tomorrow these days, but I'm LinkedIn from early. And then obviously you can find lots of demand-based content on LinkedIn, on, you know, YouTube, et cetera, and at demandbase.com. And, you know, I'm out there again, everybody's back to events. So I do tend to attend a lot of like B2B, MarTech and tech events, you know, primarily in the US, but also in the UK, and look forward to getting down to Australia one of these days too.
Oh, we'd love to have you, mate. It's definitely a different world down here, that's for sure. Well, thanks, Gareth, for your time. And we are interviewing folks just like Gareth every single week at Making Sense of MarTech, people who are pushing the envelope and pushing the industry forward in new ideas, new concepts, and new strategies to actually drive marketing tech forward. So if you'd like to listen and subscribe, you can go to themartechweekly.com. And to stay with us there, you can subscribe to our newsletter and our podcasts. You can also, and if you've enjoyed this episode, we would love for you to give us a review and to subscribe into your favorite podcatcher as well. But Gareth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Wal. It was a pleasure.